Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Newism podcast, where we talk to social innovators and disruptors to discover how they would shape a new, more inclusive economic system fit for the modern world. Our guest this week is Dr. Andrew Murray, who qualified in sport and exercise medicine and general practice and currently works as an author, speaker and researcher, advocating for a healthier and more active life for all. He has worked with many institutions, including as the Scottish Government's physical activity champion, and is a well-known extreme runner.
I'm speaking with Andrew Murray today, and we're talking about the issue of health mainly, but of course health covers all aspects of our lives, not just the health bit. So first of all, tell me how you got involved in the whole health area. You graduated as a doctor and then were practicing as a doctor, and then how did you get into this whole area?
That's right. So I qualified as a medical doctor. I grew up in rural Kenya, where my parents are missionary doctors. Right. And then came back and went to Scotland, went to school, did med school, and then had the opportunity to go and travel a bit. And I guess, you know, experience is the best teacher. So having had the opportunity to work in about 60 different countries, either doing stuff as a general practitioner or a family practitioner or a hospital doctor or working in sport or expeditions, it's just been a great eye-opener, and to see the way that different parts of the world practice medicine and the different amazing things that are out there.
So what? Give me some example of the amazing things that are there that you kind of discovered in all these countries.
Well, speaking to Professor Hans Rosling, he shared that now is the true age of acceleration. I mean, we've put a man on the moon and there have been various other pretty epic things that have been achieved by human civilization. But picture this, I mean, human life expectancy has gone up by almost a factor of 3 in the last 200 years. So the UK and the Netherlands used to be ahead of the curve. 200 years ago, our life expectancy was quite healthy at almost 40. But globally, it was about 25. So you and I would both be dead.
Right.
You know, 200 years ago.
I'd be dead a number of times over.
Exactly, you know. And I mean, isn't it amazing to think that life expectancy worldwide is almost 70? That's almost 3 times more than it was 200 years ago. Think about how long humans have been on the earth for, and just the advances that have been made. And it's not the things that you'd necessarily think of in terms of clot-busting drugs and rescue helicopters and things like that. The things that have made the biggest differences are the simplest things. It's been sanitation, immunizations, things like that. And I guess that's been the exciting thing now is when I qualified as a medical doctor, I thought that the best thing to do would be to prescribe various medications and support people to get operations. And those things are so important and are really important. But there's far more that we can do. And actually, most of health's not down to doctors. It's what we can achieve together as a community.
So explain that, but that's fascinating. I mean, we're looking at this kind of newism about the way we should be going forward. So explain what you mean about that, because for so many people, health is about going to the doctor and getting that prescription and then feeling better. You're talking about something different about the community. So explain a bit about that. So
absolutely. I mean, many people in Scotland or further afield perceive health as the absence of disease, but it's far more than that. It's essentially a complete sense of wellness. It's about well-being. It's about the absence of disease. And I think there's a fella a while ago said that it's much easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. And that's absolutely true. I think a great opportunity is to work at what proactively you can do to increase health and well-being and happiness. And it's very possible. I mean, some concrete things are to look at, you know, what we eat, health eating, looking at regular physical activity. If you go from being a couch potato to doing 30 minutes of walking 5 times a week, you live on average 7 years longer. You're on average much happier. You're also more productive, which is, I suppose, a big thing for our business leaders. And also it can help prevent and treat about 40 major chronic diseases. And we're not talking about things like athlete's foot and blisters. You know, they're the things that can go wrong. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, if you talk about physical activity, then essentially you're talking about a 30 to 40% decrease in heart attacks, 30 to 40% decrease in type 2 diabetes, quite a lot of types of cancer, such as breast cancer, bowel cancer, but it's also really, really positive for the brain. So if you're regularly physically active, and it doesn't matter how you do it, it might be walking, it might be taking part in sport, it might be taking the dog for a walk, it might be taking the stairs rather than taking the lift. You know, you can expect that to be good for the brain. Significantly decreases the chance to get depression, anxiety or dementia. And indeed, if you are unfortunate enough to suffer these conditions, it can make them significantly better.
So, how, I mean, that's really fascinating and interesting. But is that message getting through to the global population? Because it wouldn't appear to be. All the stories we get, we hear about are increasing in obesity, the fact that we're actually eating rubbish and continue to eat rubbish and then we're becoming sicker. But these statistics that you're giving, really logically, any human being would be going, goodness me, I'm going to have to change my lifestyle then. But it doesn't appear that we're necessarily doing that.
Well, absolutely. So the things that determine health and well-being are different in different parts of the world. So again, having been brought up in Kenya, the things that caused people to die and to become unwell in Kenya are quite different to what would happen in Scotland. So it could be due to infectious diseases, it can be due to a lack of food rather than too much food. It can be due to a lack of proper sanitation in certain rural areas. So it does depend, and sometimes it's just not that straightforward. But there are certain things that the human body loves, and essentially a sense of purpose. So feeling part of something, having the opportunity to contribute and add value is associated with better health outcomes. Eating the right sort of stuff and essentially making sure that, for example, in some parts of the world, it's about producing the right stuff and having enough of the right sort of food to eat in terms of protein, carbohydrate, fats, fresh fruit and vegetables, etc. Enough clean water is another key thing. But in the Western world, you're dead right. I mean, essentially, our leaders and policymakers are kind of up and against it because you've got an obesogenic environment. If you think about the amount of advertising that's on TV, if something's advertised on TV, it's probably bad for you. Think about it. And they're offering humongous portion sizes. The world is getting larger in terms of all that sort of thing. And sometimes it can actually be difficult to work out what is good for you in terms of water, fresh air, time with friends and family, opportunities to relax, and in terms of food, in concrete terms, fresh fruit and vegetables, oily fish, everything in moderation, and the life's a good one from that point of view.
So how do we, I mean, the role of, you know, in this kind of new ism we're looking at, one of the areas we're concentrating on is what's the role of government? So if this is obviously the level of potential ill health as a result of doing all of these things wrongly, increases the health budgets. And so there's a kind of imperative on government to kind of say, okay, actually, we're going to have to do something about this, quite apart from the effect on the individual. What's the role of government in this? Because governments are powerful. They can ban advertising. They can say, no, by the way, we're not stocking this food. They can tax certain foods, sugary foods, to whatever they like, to change people's behaviours. Do you think government should be doing that, or is it about the population as a whole taking responsibility?
I think we can look at some bright spots, some things that have worked and some things that are positively impacting change. So the first is free access to free healthcare. You know, access is free for those that are least able to pay for it is extremely important on a worldwide basis. Access to sanitation, access to immunisations. Again, these are extremely cost-effective things that don't cost that much but can make a massive difference to human health. In terms of what we can do in the UK, what we can do in North America, Australasia, there's some great examples. Essentially, making cigarettes more expensive is important, and the same goes for minimum pricing of alcohol. So that's not to say that people should live a monastic existence and not have a drink and not feel able to enjoy themselves. But essentially, if we can make choices that are healthy, the default, or cheaper alternatives. So if, for example, water is cheaper than beer, I'd imagine that would be a good thing.
Yeah.
And that's not always the case. And it's the same in terms of for the sugar tax. Again, I think that's a really important step. We're not saying people shouldn't eat sugar and stuff like that. But if, for example, fresh fruit and vegetables are at least affordable compared to these products that we know are bad for us, then that would be a good thing, and I'm sure our dentist colleagues would thank us for. But I think the thing about it is that the one thing we can all do is recognise that we've all got an opportunity to change the world and to make things better. And I remember the first time I realised that I was missing a trick was actually a time that I was running a 4,300-kilometre jog from John O'Groats to the Sahara Desert. And I had a lot of time to run. We're running 34 miles a day, about 5 hours or 6 hours per day without any sort of breaks in terms of taking any days off. But that gives you 8 hours to sleep and also gives you about 10 hours to think. So during that time, I was sitting, reading and listening to other people, podcasts, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, do you know, I'm not doing it. As a general practitioner, as a family practitioner, I'm just missing so much. I'm directing people towards medications and to things that are cures rather than actually thinking about prevention as well. We can all do this. We've absolutely got the opportunity to think about what we can contribute, you know, as teachers in education, working out how we can support our kids and pupils towards making healthy lifestyle choices in terms of what they eat, giving them a sense of purpose, giving them a sense of optimism, giving people the chance to be physically active in terms of taking part in sport or walking a mile a day or just doing something that helps them out. In terms of health, again, you know, our healthcare practitioners can, every time that you're in hospital, I've been asked if I've ever had gallstones, I've been asked about alcohol intake, but I've not been asked if I'm regularly physically active, I've not been asked about what I eat, and we know what we eat is one of the most important things that we do. So, you know, our health professionals can all ask that question and then hopefully instruct accordingly, or at least give people information if they're receptive to it. Again, we're not telling people what to do, but we're giving people information and helping them to make choices that they want to. You know, local authorities, governments, communications, sport is a great example. Do you know, for inspiring people to take part in sport, but also making it really inclusive. So working out how we can give everyone the opportunity to take part and to make the offer accessible. I think that's really, really important. And we can get that message across, you know. Regular physical activity is one of the best things that we can do for our health. We can also, you know, get that message out there that, you know, sugary products are not likely to be good for you, but fresh fruit and vegetables. People think that everyone knows it, but not everyone does when you look at the surveys there. But I do think that another, a really important thing is just also just building social connections, because again, I mean, Antonovsky's work and various other throughout history has just focused that one of the best things you can do from folk is to build links and to strengthen communities and give people the opportunity to be engaged and involved with things.
So a lot of that's really interesting and fascinating, but I just want to focus on one and the whole issue of community. So, because in, you know, when we speak to other people in this kind of theme, this comes up a lot. And it's almost like with globalization, if you like, so we all want to be members of this world, and you've, as you say, you've been in a lot of countries and you've run phenomenal amounts of distance through these countries, and you can do that by connecting the internet and so on and so forth. You can meet people over the world, you can go on holidays, different countries. We all seem to want that. But it seems that we potentially have given up this sense of community and then sense of who we are, which is causing us some distress. And so the question is, how do we rebuild these communities so that there is a kind of sense of purpose?
And that's a great question. And I think that, you know, there is, in my view, not a single solution, but there's great opportunities there. So people know what works for their community. So it might be about asking communities, what do you think would be most helpful? What would work for you? How can we support you? What are the things that would work best? And listening and reflecting and supporting that. I mean, I guess I've been part of projects before that we've kind of imposed stuff on people and it hasn't really worked. But when we've actually really taken the time to think and to listen, then that's when things have succeeded best.
Yeah, so it's a question of listening to people out there within communities and then encouraging people to get to be involved. And giving people that sense of purpose, it's absolutely true. I kind of believe if you do that, if you have a sense of purpose, a reason to get up in the morning, if you like, which isn't necessarily just going to the day job, if you like, but this might be something else that's going on. Actually, people are very constructive and positive if they have that opportunity.
100%.
I mean, I've seen that, as you know, I do this, I'm involved in establishing the Homeless World Cup, and so we work with what might be described as the most marginalised people on the planet. The people with the lowest self-esteem and self-respect, and we use sport, the word is used, we use sport as a vehicle to create change, and I have seen in front of my eyes some of the spectacular changes in people. Some people have had major drug problems, serious drug problems, and changed and come off drugs completely because they had this purpose, when the purpose was getting on the team to play, to represent the and it's a very, sport in particular, it's a very powerful tool. But also, when you see people that they've got a role and a sense of purpose, then you can create change.
Absolutely, and it's really interesting because you and I have both worked in sport, and the same things that influence success in sport also influence success more widely. I mean, the difference between first and fourth in the Olympics is 0.4 of 1%. What gives the athletes that 1%? I mean, a lot of people will say that there's a clear focus, knowing exactly what you're wanting to achieve and going after it, involving the right people, if you've got the right team around you, or if you're involving people that can help you succeed, then it's far easier doing that as a team rather than carrying a burden on yourself. But I think also people that have got a sense of purpose and feel part of a team are resilient. So they've got that sense of cohesion and they've got that sense of togetherness and wanting to get stuff done and being involved in something that's bigger than them. But again, if you look at the building blocks of success in terms of business, in terms of sport, in terms of just in general, for my kids, for example, you know, if you sleep like a champion, if you're an adult and you sleep between 7 and 9 hours per day, you're in a great place. When I've slept for 5 hours, I'm not in a great place. Yeah. But it's easier said than done. So, you know, simple things like putting your smartphone away for the last hour before you go to bed can make an enormous difference. Yeah. Again, what you eat, rubbish in, rubbish out, you know, in terms of business, in terms of sport, in terms of our kids. If you feed yourself well or if you feed others sort of well, then you're going to get the most out of yourself. I think, again, regular physical activity, whilst our members of the population are not all going to win Olympic medals like Usain Bolt, then they can get the same benefits that they get in terms of happiness, in terms of increased productivity, in terms of increased longevity. Olympic athletes live, you know, a good 7 to 9 years longer than the general population. And there can be many reasons for that, but physical activity is definitely a part of it. And then I think there's also that sort of camaraderiness and the social connections and other stuff that sport brings that's really, really powerful and important as well.
I think the message sports needs to get across is that, yeah, you can be an Olympic champion, but also you can be not very good at sport but still participate in it and get a great deal out of it. And sometimes I think sport's not so good at telling that story, but there are literally thousands of people in different countries in the world who enjoy sport and are living longer as a result.
Yeah, and that's a really, really important point. I mean, my kids are about to turn 4 and 2, and my wife and I were just reflecting on the best things that you can give them as presents. I mean, think of a present that can make your kids happier. Think of a present that can help them get better marks at school. Something that can actually help them prevent and treat more than 40 chronic diseases, and something that will help them live 7 years longer. So if you introduce your kid to sport or regular physical activity, then it's just a fantastic present and a big legacy that you're giving them. So I think that it's fantastic seeing the Olympic Games, the Commonwealth Games, the Paralympic Games, the Homeless World Cup, these big iconic sporting occasions that people can engage with and watch and celebrate. But it's also just the actual taking part. Be that walking, be that dancing, be that being physically active in terms of your commute. These are things that we can get done. It doesn't need to be that difficult, and it can be sport. I mean, there's such a variety of amazing sports that you can play right across the world. And I think sport's got that opportunity as well, is within the offer that it has to also engage folks in messaging around physical activity and the fact that we do have the opportunity to be inclusive, to involve all of society. I mean, I'm involved in golf for work, the European Tour, and that's a sport that can be played from 4 to 104. Yeah. My three-year-old started to play. My dad plays. And the three of us can happily be found, you know, smashing a few balls around and just sharing a bit of a laugh about how bad dad is.
Sure, that's not the case.
It is.
But another thing I've noticed with the Homeless World Cup is one of the, it's a kind of like life's learnings, I think, that sport can teach. And I've really noticed about them with homeless guys who have very low self-esteem, so they think all the time that they're kind of going to lose. So the big learning they get is that everybody loses. Everybody has a bad day, so you can lose a game of football, and actually the next day you can win the game of football. So when you lose a game of football, it's not the end of the world. It might be for a couple of minutes, but afterwards. And that is a big learning for life, particularly if you're in a position where you have such low self-esteem where you think you're just going to lose. And so consequently, you lose. So sport has a lot of lessons, I think. It's just one example.
Yeah, I think it's a really good thing, is that it's not just about the sport itself, but it's about the lessons that are associated with it. Again, I conducted a big study with the University of Edinburgh and the World Golf Foundation looking at golf, and it just showed that essentially those that play golf in this instance, but it would translate to other sports, have increased self-esteem, increased self-worth. These are good things. We want to feel good about ourselves. We want to feel as if we're able to contribute. We want to have a big fat smile on our face. And that's something that sport can do for sure. You know, I think it's also something that other modes of physical activity and other things in life can do. So I think time spent doing other physical activities is important, but also time laughing, yeah. Time with family, time relaxing, having some time to yourself. recognising that the world is a hell of a busy place, but if we can prioritise some time for self, for sleep, for eating well, and things like that, then it's potentially money in the bank for us in the longer term. And I guess that goes for individuals, but if our governments, if our local authorities, if our community planners are able to be far-sighted on that, and there's some great examples of that at our work in Scotland. I've done some work for the Scottish Government. We're also looking at the Global Action Plan for Physical Activity for the World Health Organization that's launching in 2017. Again, I mean, the clear message is that everyone's got an opportunity to contribute. Everyone can improve their own health to a degree, but then also contribute to their community. And it's sometimes difficult to underestimate just how powerful communities can be in improving health outcomes. And we as doctors think that we do a great job, and undoubtedly doctors, nurses, health professionals are working hard and adding value, but there are many wider determinants of health and well-being. So it's probably neglected just how important our teachers, how important our, you know, urban designists, how important our politicians, and in making a difference to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very important point you're making, because sometimes I really find that governments all over the world, different countries operate in silos. So going back to sport again, the sports in the sports box, and the health in the health box, and the urban planning's in the urban planning box. And actually what's required, if you want people to be more physically active, possibly through sports, then you need to shut some roads down. You need to get cars off roads. You also need to get people out of cars so they physically can't do it. They have to walk from A to B, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to be a lack of leadership sometimes in this area, which is required to force some of the silos to come together. Is that an experience you've had?
Yeah, there's a real opportunity for collaboration to highlight some bright spots. So, for example, we're sitting here in Scotland. Our ministers for public health, sport, transport, the chief executive of NHS, the chief executive of Transport Scotland, all got together and looked at policies that could get more people more physically active, and doubled the budget for active travel. And that was a really collaborative effort, not only to increase and to find the budget, but then also to work out how to spend it sensibly. Again, there's initiatives relating to 20 mile an hour. There's the Daily Mile, which is an initiative to get every child in Scotland to walk a mile or to be active for a mile each day. So these are real positive things. And the key thing for that is exactly as you're saying, Mel, it's been about collaboration, working out how to get people drinking coffee in the same room, and working out how together you can do it. And I think that there's some great examples from Brazil, some great examples from Thailand, just looking at how to mobilise and how to get people excited about physical activity, how to get people excited about sport. And doing it together, not doing things to people, but doing things with people, seems to be the lesson that people keep coming back to.
Yeah, I've been talking to, I think, Scottish Government since we're in Scotland for years about this. I mean, using this example of how every bus shelter in Rio is a mini gym, so that you have these kind of, you see these guys in suits in the morning doing pull ups and so on the gym, and then in the bus shelter rather, and then in later in the day you see kids kind of playing games, but so being physically active by playing on a bus shelter. And I kind of go, why don't you just copy that and just do that? Because there are simple things you can learn from other countries, actually, which are not expensive and people can have good fun with.
Exactly. So one thing that I'm also vice president of Rambler Scotland, and one thing we've done is put walking routes into each of the government buildings, into many of the university buildings, and into many of the hospitals. So all of the hospitals in NHS Lothian and Greater Glasgow and Clyde all have walking routes. And they medal routes, so it could be 15 minutes, 30 minutes or an hour, that people can get physically active and essentially have a route, because that again, you know, inspires a sense of purpose and a sense of achievement, etc. So, I mean, it could be as simple as to perhaps just work in walking routes to every sporting facility in Scotland. Mm-hmm. It could be about considering the same for every educational facility in Scotland, because we know that 54% of calories spent in Scotland and in the UK are spent walking. Mm-hmm. So if we can inspire folk to make that jump to walking and into sport and regular physical activity, but then also script the critical moves in terms of eating, I think that could be critical. One of the most successful campaigns in America was the 1% milk. Mm-hmm. Everyone was drinking fully fat milk in America, and in this particular town and province at that point in time. But just by actually sticking in bus shelters, as you're talking about, the logoing just say drink 1% milk, No explanation, just a simple instruction to do that. Essentially, they'll get everyone drinking semi-skimmed milk, which again, at a population level, help bring cholesterol levels down, help decrease heart attacks and things like that as well. So sometimes the simplest things can make the biggest differences.
It's fascinating. I mean, once again, some of the discussions I've been having, one of the things is about measurement. So at the moment, it seems countries are obsessed with measuring GDP as how everybody, how the country is doing. Whereas, you know, as you'll be aware, happiness indexes are starting to emerge, which are measuring completely different things, and maybe the type of things that you're talking about. In other words, how much are we walking? How much are we kind of feeling happy as a result, or fulfilled as a result of that? Do you think we should be doing more in terms of pushing these type of measures, which indicate how fulfilled a country or society might be?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I think Bhutan is, as their primary metric, looking at gross national happiness.
Yeah.
There are other countries that are...
Fascinating, yeah.
I think it's great. I mean, why are we not measuring happiness? It's just such an important thing in life. Who doesn't want to be happy?
Exactly. So what? But there's such a pushback about that because you kind of go, oh, you hear people kind of, oh, that's just namby-pamby stuff. And I was going, yeah, but actually measuring the GDP or something like the FTSE 100 is actually just a measure of how 100 companies are actually performing. So it's a very, very rough indicator, and yet it's something we all kind of... either we're very excited about because it's gone up by 1% or having feeling depressed about because it's gone down by 1%. But actually a happiness index, if that's what we're all about, is actually something that's much more valuable, seems to me.
Absolutely. I mean, people are after hard metrics. So it's that whole Edwards Deming thing, in God we trust, everyone else needs data.
Yeah. And more and more these days, it seems.
Exactly. So there is definitely a place for measuring mortality, how long people are living, how many people are getting heart attacks, to see how we can positively influence that. But I do think there's huge value in terms of just looking at how people are feeling. Are they happy? Is there social trust? Do people trust and value being part of the community they're in? How can they be better supported? What are the things that make the biggest difference to people? So again, listening to people, not only at a community, but also at a national scale, thinking about that conversation. And then just thinking about how we actually get on to do it as well. And it's difficult. I mean, no one's pretending this stuff is easy. But if we can help just listen more and work with people towards what solutions are undoubtedly there, I think we'll be in a great place.
Are you positive about the outcome for the world? Or you're obviously not a pessimist, so otherwise you wouldn't be sitting here talking about this. But are we making progress? Are things happening?
Yeah, I think Mark Stevenson said it's the age of acceleration. Things are improving and evolving at a greater pace than in human history. Life expectancy has almost tripled. If you look at technology, we've gone from having no smartphones and no internet in my lifetime, I'm 37, to now having ubiquitous internet, ubiquitous smartphones that are able to do pretty much everything, like produce thunderbolts from your backside and take photos, and just everything can be achieved. And it's just working out, you know, what are the most important next steps? And it seems to be the ones that you've identified, really, is just actually what makes people happy. What is it that matters to people? And from my perspective, just from a health and well-being perspective, I think we've had a good look at smoking and a good look at alcohol, and these things remain important. But how do we give people a sense of purpose? How can we institute regular physical activity or sport into daily life? How can we get the right information to people so that they can make healthy choices in relation to what is eaten? And if we can get that done in the next 200 years, we'll be good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, why not? We might not be alive around, you know, 200 years, who knows? But I mean, it's interesting as well that what you're saying about the pace of change. I'm always kind of going on about that, actually, because unless you're a change organisation, you've had it, because the change is going on around. But I'm not so sure that that's not one of the reasons which is giving a lot of us humans angst, that we just need a bit of space, actually, and a bit of kind of actually think this could slow down. Do you think this whole change that's going on, some people say we're living through the fourth industrial revolution, you never know you're in a revolution until afterwards, history will tell you, but possibly we are. People will look back on it as a phenomenal age. But do you think that stress really causing stress, this continual change from nothing's the same from day to day anymore? And that's everywhere, politics, phones, anything. It's not, nothing stays the same.
I think looking at historical models, we're moving up the Maslow's historical hierarchy of need. So in terms of the UK, there are fewer people that are, and still there are a huge and significant number that are hungry and are looking for shelter, and that's the most important thing. But I think that increasingly people are looking for self-fulfillment, self-efficacy, for happiness and things like that. And change is scary. It's something that not everyone will embrace, but it's inevitable, and it's happening all of the time now. So I guess it makes the time that you have got in terms of relaxation and with family even a higher priority. But I think that many folk, including myself, to be honest, sometimes struggle to get that balance right in terms of making sure that you're working at what's important. And I guess throughout human history, it's always been shelter, food, family, community, etc. Mm-hmm. And then everything that's on top of that is kind of a bonus. We don't really need iPhones, do we?
No, we don't. I was interested in some number of people that kind of turn them off, but it's interesting, the data. I mean, I'm fascinated about this whole area of kind of change and what motivates people. I mean, you've done these amazing marathons, Lenta. I mean, how far was it from John O'Groats to Sahara Desert you're in?
Yeah, that one was 4,300 kilometres.
So what was driving you to do that? I bet you've been asked this question lots of times, but what made you do that? There's not many people would do that.
Scotland to Sahara, we're looking to raise a whole lot of cash for a charity I was really passionate about, the Amar Trust in Outer Mongolia. I was also due to get married 3 months after, so I was pretty keen to avoid as much wedding planning as possible.
So what was the charity? What was that?
It was like the Amar Trust.
What's that
do? We were essentially establishing social housing, social connections, and trying to take care of medical needs like cataracts and things like that in Outer Mongolia and communities. So it was about going out there and working out what was most important and then helping deliver that. So there was a large population of people with cataracts that, again, for £80 you can do a cataract operation and give people sight again. So it was incredible in terms of the value. Again, we think that housing is quite expensive in the UK, and the cost of putting up a house in Mongolia at that time to give a family a home, it was like £500 to £1,000. And if you think about their summers being plus 30 and their winters being minus 40, then it's a difficult place not to have a home. But I think...
So that's what motivation you, that's what drives you, just basically raising money. But it's a long way to go.
Kind of.
It's a phenomenal achievement.
Kind of. I mean, to be honest with you, I just wanted to do it. You know, I love the Sahara Desert. A lot of the places that I do run are places that are scientifically challenging. So I'm not a particularly good runner, so I kind of need to use a bit of science to gain a bit of an advantage. So quite often I'll go and race at the North Pole or Antarctica or the Namib Desert. We ran across that, but I actually made a mistake. I pitched up in November to run right across the Namib, thinking that it was their winter, but November down there is their summer, so it's 50 degrees when I landed.
What was his temperature?
It was 50 degrees. Yeah, so that's hot weather for a ginger.
Yeah. For a Scot, yeah.
But it's something to do, you know. Again, it's a sense of purpose. It's testing yourself, seeing what's out there, you know, learning stuff, meeting new people, raising a bit of money. Like, there's a whole range of things that went into it.
And I guess you're learning about yourself in these situations as well. I mean, apart from stopping reading books, when you're running through the middle of the desert, you must be kind of thinking, right, I'm at my limit.
For sure. You know, check the calendar more carefully. apply sunscreen a bit more rigorously. I think I said, like, experience is the best teacher. So I'd much rather give something a shot. And if it doesn't work out, then at least you've tried it. And there's lots of things I've tried and haven't worked out. But some of them have.
But that's an interesting point as well, I think, because it's about being entrepreneurial. So, again, it's back to this whole business to get the sport. You try things and they don't work. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the end of the world. It just didn't work, so you can move on to the next race. Didn't do well in a particular race, you can move on to the next race. That's a big learning, isn't it?
Yeah, I think most of the sports people I've spoken to have got beat quite a large number of times.
Yeah. Well, even the best ones in the world. If you actually look at... Examine the real champions. They've actually been beaten and then learnt why they lost. I think that's my experience of reading. Even these, you know, I speak with the homeless footballers sometimes, and I say to them, you know, Lionel Messi or Ronaldo, they've never won the World Cup.
Uh-huh.
Actually, they've been beaten, but they're determined to win it, and they will probably one day, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. You know, some of the most famous sport folk on earth are still slightly unfulfilled in terms of what they'd say themselves. And you see that in a British sports folk. Like, I think, you know, Mo Farah himself would say that essentially the reason he has succeeded is because he worked out what the competition were doing and managed to close the gap successfully. Essentially sleep a bit better, eat even better, do some of the physical preparation that was necessary to beat the Kenyans and the Ethiopians at their own game. I mean, you see it in our own elite sport folk in Scotland in terms of Chris Hoy, Andy Murray, etc. They've worked out what they're doing, but they're also aware of what else is out there and what other people are doing, and they're always pushing it and always learning. And
it was very interesting what you were saying earlier, and I was going to pick up on it, but it's good to just raise it now. I mean, in all these people, and including yourself, actually, you've got teams of people are there and as part of that, and without the team, they wouldn't succeed. So it is about the individual, but it's also about a lot of other people in that team. And that actually mirrors maybe back to community. You can't kind of exist on your own. There's communities around in terms of whatever it is you're trying to do.
Exactly. And I think what you were saying about silos really strikes home. Because if you look at education, if you look at business, if you look at sport, if you look at all these things, the same things really drive change. So it's a great opportunity to learn from each other. And in the runs that I've done, I mean, people will see, you know, on the TV or doing stuff, essentially just running through these massive sand dunes or running in the Arctic in winter and doing all that sort of stuff. But there's a lot of people that help you get there. There's a lot of people that actually do the stuff that gets you there. And in a way, it's nice. It's nice to feel a part of it. And it's nice to know that you're kind of, and it's also a bit scary as well. You know, if you're kind of the front man for some sort of expedition,
yeah,
and it goes wrong, you undoubtedly feel that you're letting folk down.
Yeah. So is that motivated to not to succeed, I guess?
Yeah, that's exactly it, you know. So, for example, when I ran to the Sahara, and there's been a couple other times that have been similar, I knew that there was a, you know, an hour on BBC about it. I knew there's a few other bits and pieces going on. And after three weeks, I had terrible Achilles tendons. They looked like sticks of rhubarb. And a couple of the guys just thought, oh, you're going to have to stop. I mean, things are pretty swollen. Things look pretty ugly there. And part of it was just a fear of looking like an absolute turkey and not even getting out of the UK. So essentially it's about speaking to physios, speaking to podiatrists, taking that information and working out how you could recognise the issue but then just find a solution that's associated with it. And once we got into flatter ground and out of the snow and stuff, it turned out it was fine.
Yeah, it's so interesting as well, because sport, like anything else, has so come on in terms of its development, because I remember the days when I was younger and I was watching football, you know, and the footballers apparently would have a fag before the game and one at half time and get a couple of pints of beer and before games or something, and then go and play. And we're pretty good actually, but of course they couldn't lace the boots of the guys these days, because they've got all the nutritionists and psychologists and everything behind them, and it'd be a shot, I guess, at dawn if they had a cigarette before a game.
Absolutely. So if you look at Team GB, if you look at Sport Scotland, if you look at these great sporting organisations, there's always a team behind the team. So it's very rare that the sports person, the sportswoman or the sportsman is doing it all by themselves. They've often nowadays got a huge team behind them in terms of physiotherapists, physical preparation, psychologists, sports doctors, nutritionists, and just a range of real experts that can help add value and contribute that extra, be that 0.1 of 1%, 0.5 of 1%. And it's families as well, you know. Yeah. The athletes will often share how important family and friends and all that sort of stuff and sponsors and people that are part of that journey with them are. So it's a big team effort, sport nowadays.
So in a sense, because that's successful, you could apply that to anything then. You could be saying, well, if you're going to work as a business person or you're going to work as a somebody who works in the railways, it's important to have teams of people around you who are supporting you in your work, and that would include your family and your community.
100%. So again, I mean, if you look at some of the examples of things that have succeeded, like the Homeless World Cup or Sport Scotland, then again, it's been a massive team effort. There's not just one person telling everyone what to do. It's about people listening and people working out how the people can actually help support and get you from A to B. So it's kind of a really distributed approach rather than it being one person in charge, and there's just lots of people that are contributing and just doing things that alone that other person couldn't have done. And I think the model of business is changing to an extent from an all-conquering chief executive to more a more social and distributed model that people are thinking about who's part of their organisation that could add value and they can step up and just direct a certain aspect of it. Yeah. And if you listen to Sir Harry Burns, who is our previous Chief Medical Officer for Scotland, I think that's what he sees, is that again, in terms of health and social care, it's the ministers obviously help directing stuff, but everyone can contribute and feed into that conversation, make things happen, influence health in a range of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. So, just to conclude, then, that really what we're saying in this kind of new world, if we start with blank bits of paper, etc., health is actually a key part. Good health, but good health isn't just about going, you know, getting a prescription for something you might be feeling. Health actually covers all aspects of our life, from the moment we're born to the moment we die, in terms of our own well-being and our collective well-being. And we need to have that high on the agenda in a world where we're much happier. Is that kind of one of your conclusions?
Absolutely. And I think the same things that help you to have good health are the same things that will help you succeed in life and to be happy as well. So again, sleeping well, having some time to relax and spend some time with family, eating well, regular physical activity. They're absolute pillars of performance in terms of from a business or from a sporting perspective, but they're just so important in general in terms of health and happiness as well.
Okay. Well, this has been fascinating chatting to you. I could go on for ages chatting to you more about a lot of these areas, but it's been really, really interesting, and I have a much greater understanding of where health sits in the world. So thank you very much for your time. It's been great talking.
No, thank you, Mel.
Andrew's belief that community and purpose are the foundations for a happy and healthy life is inspiring and galvanising. We hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so do get in touch via Twitter at News and Talks or our website, newsandtalks.com. Next week, Mel talks to Pip Wheaton, director of Ashoka UK, which supports and promotes social entrepreneurship. We hope to see you there.